The following is an excerpt from the Science Podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Finally today, I'm Carrie Klein, and I'm here with online news editor David Grimm, who's going to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our online daily news site. So, Dave, in our first story, we're talking about friendly viruses. As we learn more about our microbiome, we learn that bacteria can be both friends and foes, and now a new study tells us that the same might be true for viruses.
Right, Carrie. This microbiome is the population of bacteria that we have on our body. And recent studies have shown this bacteria can actually be very helpful. For example, one recent study showed that the bacteria on our face can actually help prevent acne. And researchers have shown that bacteria in our guts can actually help us potentially even lose weight. But nobody's really looked at the viruses that live on us. And there are actually a lot of viruses that live on us as well. Viruses tend to inhabit mucus. And mucus is, of course, the slimy substance. It coats the inside of our mouths, our nose, eyelids, and our digestive tract. It's got bacteria in it. And this new study reveals that it actually has a lot of phages in it, too. And phages are basically viruses that invade and kill bacteria.
So what are these phages in this mucus doing?
Well, that's what the researchers set out to figure out. And what they found was they grew human lung tissue in the lab. And lungs are one of the body surfaces that are protected by mucus in humans. And the researchers had E. coli, which can be a very dangerous bacterium, invade this lung tissue. And what they found was that the lung tissue that didn't have a protective coating of mucus that also contained phages in it fared a lot worse than the lung tissue that had mucus but did have phages in it, which suggests that the phages are critical for fighting off these harmful bacteria.
So the mucus itself may not actually be as protective as the phages that it carries.
Right, exactly. The mucus probably has a protective aspect, but it's really these phages that are inside the mucus that are helping to defend us. And what's really interesting is we're obviously not the only animal that has mucus. There's a lot of creatures on Earth that have mucus, worms and corals, for example. And the researchers found where they looked at the mucus of a lot of these species, they were finding phages in them, which suggests that phages actually may play an important part in a sort of immune system for a lot of species on Earth.
So it sounds like this could really provide a lot of insight into diseases that affect mucosal membranes like the lungs, the bowels, things like that.
Exactly. And actually, one of the diseases mentioned in this article is inflammatory bowel disease. And we know we have this ecosystem of hundreds of bacterial species in our gut, but patients with IBD have a disrupted ecosystem with different dominant species. It's possible that the phages are actually playing a role in this, that viruses are attacking certain bacteria and not attacking others. And one way to combat IBD may not be to focus on the bacteria, but actually to focus on some of the viruses that live in our guts.
And in our next story, we're talking about how Neanderthal mothers cared for their young. Ancient teeth from our ancestors have been extremely useful in learning about how they lived, and now we're even learning about how baby Neanderthals may have been fed.
That's right, Carrie. Teeth can actually tell us a lot of stuff. The simple morphology of teeth can reveal what species they came from, what kind of diets they had, but nobody's really looked at how teeth can actually shed light on breastfeeding behavior. And the reason teeth can even shed light on this in the first place is because you can sort of think of teeth as tree rings in a sense. Every day they lay down layers of dentine and enamel. And this dentine and enamel actually contains traces of a chemical called barium, which is an element similar to calcium. And it's present in water sources and many types of soil. It's also present in high levels in breast milk. So you can imagine when a baby is breastfeeding, there's going to be a lot of layers containing high levels of barium in those very early rings of the teeth because the baby's drinking a lot of breast milk. But when the baby is weaned off the breast milk, you're going to have less barium because there's going to be less barium in their diet. We know that's the case for humans. And the question in this study is, how can we take that knowledge and apply it to other animals and even potentially Neanderthals to figure out how other species practice their weaning behavior?
Can breast milk be distinguished from other kinds of milk and other sources of calcium in our diet?
Well, the interesting thing with humans is actually a lot of human babies, after they're weaned off breast milk, actually go to infant formula, which actually has higher levels of barium, which also can reveal some interesting information. If you see all of a sudden this spike in barium, you might assume, okay, well, this baby maybe had breast milk for 6 months, and then maybe for the next 6 months had formula, and then maybe you'll see this big drop in barium, and you'll say, okay, well, now it looks like the baby's being weaned off breast milk and infant formula altogether and is eating more of a normal diet, which has a lot less barium in it.
Okay, so you said that these analyses have been pretty accurate on human babies. So what did we find with Neanderthal teeth?
Well, the researchers actually only looked at one Neanderthal tooth, and this was from a child that lived about 100,000 years ago. This is a molar found in a cave in Belgium. And the researchers did some laser scanning of the tooth, which allowed them to look at all these different layers of the tooth. And what they found was that the barium level started off pretty high right after birth, and they continued to be elevated for 7 months. And this suggests that this baby was exclusively breastfeeding for 7 months. Then the barium levels fell to intermediate levels for another 7 months. And this suggests that the mother's milk was being supplemented by other food sources. So the baby was still getting breast milk, but possibly also eating other food as well. And then after about 1.2 years, the barium levels really dropped off. And this suggests that the child wasn't drinking any breast milk anymore and potentially was actually very abruptly weaned from the breast milk and really just sort of forced to eat more normal foods.
Okay, so in this particular example, this baby started to be weaned around 7 months, and then a little over a year, it appeared to be fully weaned. Is this earlier or later than we expected from Neanderthals?
It's pretty early, and it's also a lot earlier than is seen in modern humans, especially those humans that live in non-industrial societies, where weaning doesn't actually take place until about 30 months. And this analysis of this Neanderthal tooth suggests that Neanderthals were weaned very early in life, which also suggests that they might have developed a lot faster than we did, which is actually a going hypothesis. Experts caution, you won't want to make sweeping conclusions just based on one tooth found in one cave, but it is really sort of a nice affirmation of this technique, which shows just how much information is available simply by looking for this one element in the sort of tree rings of teeth.
And our last story is about penguins and why they don't fly. We know of a lot of flightless birds out there. There are emus and ostriches and also penguins. But I don't know that we necessarily know why they don't fly.
We don't really. We know that penguins are very good swimmers. And there's been this suspicion that perhaps in order to become very good swimmers, they had to give up flight to make themselves much more effective in the water. This new study lends a lot of support to that idea. It's a study of a type of bird called the murre, which is a penguin-like seabird. What's different about these birds versus penguins is they can still fly and they swim, but they're not great either, especially flying. They're actually pretty bad flyers. And the researchers said, well, maybe we can look at this bird who's sort of almost maybe in this transition stage, not really a great swimmer, not really a great flyer, but can do both. Maybe that'll provide some clues into why penguins have given up flight.
So did they answer that question?
They think they did. What they did was they looked at a group of murres that nest on cliffs in Alaska, Canada, and other northerly sites. And studying these murres wasn't easy, especially in northern Canada. The researchers actually had to carry shotguns loaded with rubber bullets to ward off the local polar bears. They lived in a cabin surrounded by an electric bear fence. Don't let anybody ever tell you that science can't be dangerous work. When they actually were able to get the murres, they outfitted them with sensors so they could get a sense of how deep they dove, how much time they spent in the air. And what they found was these animals expended a lot of energy when they flew, more than any other bird. In fact, on the wing, murres burn energy at 31 times the rate they do at rest, the highest known ratio of any bird. When other vertebrates work really hard, they're burning energy only at 25 times their resting rate. So these birds are really working hard just to be bad flyers.
And what about how they swim?
And they swim okay. They were more efficient than many other birds that swim, but they're still not great swimmers. The researchers found that comparing with penguins of the same size, murres expended far more energy while diving.
And so what does this mean for penguins who can only do one?
Well, what the researchers hypothesize is if the murre's wing became a bit more like the penguin's stubby flipper, they would be a lot better swimmers. but their ability to fly would almost be impossible. And what it suggests is that penguins may have reached a very similar point in their evolutionary history where they were able to fly a bit, able to swim a bit, but weren't able to do both very well. And for some reason decided, you know what? Life's going to be a lot easier if I just swim, but I'm a much more successful swimmer. Maybe there's a lot more food in the water, especially if I'm diving down. And so from an evolutionary perspective, it made sense for them to evolve into a place where they just became these awesome swimmers, and it was worth it to give up flight. And MERS really are shedding light on this really sort of transitional point in evolution. Animals obviously are not consciously making this decision, but where this decision is made over evolutionary history.
All right. And what else have we had on the site this week?
Well, Carrie, for Science Now, we've got a fascinating physics story that deals with the phenomenon of entanglement. This is the idea that if you observe a photon in one place, it'll actually affect the behavior of a photon in another place, potentially another place that's light years away. It's this really bizarre property that Einstein called spooky action at a distance. Now, researchers have shown that if you observe a photon at one time, you can actually affect another photon at a different time. So entanglement may not just work across space, but also across time. For Science Insider, we continue to explore the impact of the sequester. This week, the impact on biomedical research labs. Also a story about whether journals should abandon the impact factor. Finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science. This week's Science Live is about the DSM-5, the latest, what's called the Bible of psychiatry, whether it's still valuable or should be ditched. Next week's Science Live is about the ethics of studying chimpanzees in captivity. Should we abandon captivity for chimps and just study them in the wild? So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Great. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Carrie.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out all of our news at news.sciencemag.org, including daily stories from Science Now, Science Policy from Science Insider, and Science Live, live chats on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.